Welcome to Warships Pod, and again we take a dive into the history of the Cold War under the sea, and my guest is Commander Rob Forsyth, who served with various submarines during that long period of confrontation between Russia and the West. And really what we're going to do is have a voyage through Rob's career from the very beginning until his time ended, and maybe have a few reflections on where submarines, submarine warfare, submarine affairs are today. So welcome, Rob.
Hello, Ian. Thank you very much for asking me on. I feel privileged to be on your podcast.
And we're privileged to have you, Rob. And could we start with just a quick background on why you decided to join the Navy, and then maybe after that go into why you chose submarines? So I know there's a whole story there, but if you could just kick off with why you decided to join the Navy as a youngster.
Okay. Well, the first one is quite quick. I was five when my father came back from the war. He was wearing uniform, and I can remember standing behind the gates in our drive, ready to open them as he drove in a car with a friend with a banner saying, "Welcome home, Daddy." And I had two thoughts. One is, I wonder what he looks like, because I had very much recollection. And secondly, when he stepped out of the car, I looked at the uniform and said, "I'm going to join the Navy." So from then on, everything was geared to me joining the Navy.
But the whole idea of going under the sea in a war vessel is something that most people are not attracted to. So how did you end up becoming a submariner?
Well, that really hadn't occurred to me. I'd gone through Dartmouth with mixed results. I was enjoyed myself at Dartmouth, probably too much to be a high flyer. Went on to minesweepers afterwards when I left Dartmouth. Enjoyed the small boat atmosphere of there, then went to a frigate, which was much more organized, spent a lot more time doing, I thought, quite dull things, mainly going from A to B, painting a ship, polishing brass, exercising sea boats and having cocktail parties. And I felt I'm not really doing very much. Then we were sent out to the Gulf, where we anchored offshore. I think we had an air-conditioned ops room, which was used as a sort of drinks venue, as far as I could see, for all the forces out. Presumably some activity went on professionally, but I didn't see much of it. And I got a bit bored. And after a while, my captain had me in one day, and he said, "Forsyth, I think we have to do something about you. Your informal approach to discipline is not going to get you very far in the Navy. In fact, I think you'd make a good submariner. So we're going to land you at Mombasa next week, make your way to Nairobi, go back to UK and start a submarine course." And I said, not sure about that. He said, "No choice. You've joined the Navy, become a submariner."
All right.
Meeting over. I was a non-volunteer until I started the submarine course. But the day I went to sea in a submarine, I thought, this is for me.
And that experience out in the Gulf, which was 1961, when Iraq pre-Saddam threatened to invade the Emirates over some dispute, which we won't go into here, that was the very, would you say that was the very early days of the Cold War? Because I think fairly soon you were plunged into what was one of the most dangerous periods of the Cold War, weren't you, as a submariner, young submariner officer?
Yeah, it sort of went from one extreme to the other. We were an air defence frigate with a lot of radar equipment, and that's why we had air conditioning in our ops room. It became a cocktail party venue. But actually, that didn't involve me very much, and I did get excited by it. But I finished my submarine training class, joined Auriga, went for workup. And after we completed workup in 62, we were told to store for war and sail immediately, which was the Cuba crisis. So I found myself suddenly becoming a war, going to war.
So Auriga, just to set the scene for listeners not familiar with all sorts of submarines, the wide variety of submarines, Auriga was a diesel-electric submarine, what could be considered, tip of the spear in those days, or second line? I mean, how would you characterize Auriga? What kind of submarine?
Well, she was just a World War II boat built in 1944, but still a mainstay of the fleet. But the Pauper's class submarines, the successors, had come in, and they were significantly more capable than the A-boats. But the A-boats still had a big role to play in particularly we carried a sonar set called 186, which was a long-range listening device. And I guess that's what we were sent to see in 62, was to detect Soviet submarines.
And as a young officer, you were, I believe, you were the torpedo officer. So when it comes to taking aboard the weaponry, which the submarine would use should it come to a hot confrontation with the Russians, you were responsible for loading those weapons, were you?
Well, I was called the torpedo officer, but the person who was the torpedo officer, of course, was a petty officer, very experienced submariner, who said to me, okay, Lieutenant Forsyth, stand close to me, watch what I do and learn, okay? And then every now and then allowed me to give an order if it was safe to do so. So I wouldn't say I was too skilled at this stage. But yes, we were loading war torpedoes with warheads and sails.
Aboard the submarine at that time, was there a feeling of tension? I mean, did you actually know too much about the Cuban Missile Crisis and what was going on?
No. In fact, we were pretty in the dark. We knew there was a crisis in Cuba. I don't think we had appreciated. We knew it was building. I don't think we appreciated quite how acute it was. Governments are very poor on giving out real information. And I think we were excited. This was operational, what we joined for, but we were fairly in the dark as to what we were going to do or what the results might be.
Did Auriga actually detect any Russians? Because they were obviously going, I would think,
No.
I didn't get any, because they would have gone, I know that they quite a few of them went from the north, where the main Russian bases were up in the Arctic, down on a sort of expressway. And in particular, four submarines were sent, armed with nuclear tipped torpedoes, which we found out later. And so it was quite a big thing. But Auriga was kept on the periphery, or just didn't find any wherever she was?
I think we didn't go far enough out, and we were too late. Of course, we had some A-boat cousins who were based in Canada, in Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is where we were destined to go. And they sailed, and they had the interesting situation of having Canadian officers on board under RN command, and I believe they ripped their Canada strips off their shoulders, so they were unidentifiable, and they went to sea in an RN capacity.
And that was because the Canadian government had a different stance to the British and the Americans, was it? That they had to take the flashes off, the Canada flashes off, pretend they weren't aboard?
Yes, officially the Canadians were not directly involved.
Right, and they did...
But we did have quite a few Canadian and Australian officers serving in the Royal Navy at the time, so it was inevitable we'd have a mixed crew. We didn't have any Australians, but we had several Canadians. In fact, the torpedo chap in charge of the torpedo was a Canadian.
And at that time, you say Auriga was going across the Atlantic to join the 6th Submarine Squadron at Halifax. At that time, I mean, two things occur to me. One is... it was a British squadron based in Canada, which didn't have a submarine arm at the time. But also, to make a transatlantic crossing in a diesel electric submarine must have been quite a feat, really.
Yes, yes. We were going to snort all the way across. Snorting being putting a mast up to suck air down to for the diesel engines, then the exhaust mast to get rid of exhaust. And we were going to do what we thought was going to be the first transatlantic continuous snort, which all went well until we were about a week out from Canada, when one day we realized that our sewage tank, we had a great big tank into which our very few toilet heads, as we call them, drained. We couldn't get rid of the contents to sea, because normally you put air in the shutter valve on the top, put air in the top, open a valve at the bottom, and it all gets blown out. What we couldn't do, we shut the valve on the top. And we couldn't get at it because of where it was located while dived. So we surfaced reluctantly and did the last bit of the journey on the surface with the temporary toilet rigged inside the fin and hung a notice saying vacant and engaged on the ladder up into the conning tower into the fin.
Right.
And that was fine. But of course, when we got to the other end, the press were waiting for us to hear about this transatlantic crossing. And we thought we'd just keep quiet. Best thing is say nothing. And that was fine. But sitting in the wardroom, with visiting dignitaries, some members of the press, and one thing another. At the wardroom door appears a stoker who clearly has had his arm deep into a noxious substance because it was quite brown, clutching in his hands a spoon, saying, "I found the cause of the problem, so why we had to surface."
Oh, right.
And blew the whole thing.
But did that make some headlines, or were they too polite to write up?
Well, it did locally. We were actually in St John's, Newfoundland, because we'd headed for the nearest.
Yes, yeah.
Rather than go on to Halifax.
Yeah, an experience we all know about, I'm sure, yeah, from all sorts of situations. But once in Halifax, Auriga joined, two or three other submarines to work out of there?
Yeah, there was one other submarine there with us, and so the two of us there, which was the Patton. And we were working with the Canadian Navy as there to help them train, and we also were doing under ice operations to get experience for the RN.
Right, and so at the time, the Soviet Navy was sending out its early ballistic missile submarines, just carrying two or three missiles with nuclear tips. And I gather at that time, they would their main objective, because they had a fairly short range, 200 or 300 miles, to try and hit targets in America, was to get under the ice in the Gulf of St. Lawrence and lurk there, waiting for the order that may hopefully never come. So it was your job in a diesel submarine to go under the ice there to try and find them?
No, we were more going under the ice to practice going under the ice, and I think to see whether it was feasible to do. But in fact, being a diesel submarine, you're quite limited as to what you can do, because you have to get air for the diesels periodically. And the biggest worry is, of course, you're under the ice and there's nowhere to come up. You run out of air, or if you have a fire or a flood. So what we were practicing was how to navigate under ice and how to find things called polynyas, which we used, the Russian name seemed to be convenient, for gaps in the ice surface. So we'd cruise along looking up through the periscope until you saw brighter patch than anything else stationary underneath it, and then surfaced in what would be quite thin ice. And we had round the top of the fin, like a biscuit cutter round the top of the fin, in order to give a bit of a push. And we'd hover below the polynya, blow air into the tanks, and punch our way through the fairly thin ice and emerge on the top, of which you've seen lots of photographs of people playing football, cricket, and amusing themselves on the ice.
Yeah, but quite dangerous to get there, to get up through there, wasn't it? Yeah.
I have to say, our sonar systems at the time really weren't good enough to detect submarines under the ice. There was so much noise under the ice from ice moving that unless you're under very thick stationary ice, if like we were, where we were under thinner ice, which was moving and breaking up, the background noise was extremely high.
But presumably the Russians at that time, they might have had some nuclear-powered, or the first of the nuclear-powered attack submarines were coming in, but they didn't have, I don't think, at that point, they didn't have nuclear-powered ballistic missile submarines, so they probably wouldn't have spent a lot of time under there anyway, would they? They would have dodged under themselves. Mm. Yeah, mm. Yeah, yeah. So that was pretty exciting. Was there ever a moment where you were worried that the submarine might go under the ice and not come up or not be able to find a polynya?
I think you were conscious of it all the time. And if you had gone too long, we used to track them, put them on a chart, work out how far we were from any. We used to reckon we wanted to keep within an hour of a hole, perhaps closer. But we used to track where they were. And that was part of it. But of course, our navigation was pretty rudimentary in those days. So whether we could actually have found our way back again, I was never confident. So when you came back out from the ice, there was a big collective sigh of relief. So we were, quite tense about it.
Yeah, because of course the with submarines, we assume that people know how they work. But I mean, they're actually a diesel electric submarine is a submersible, so it needs air to vent the fumes, as I think you've suggested already, to use the diesel engine on the surface, which charges the battery, which it then uses under the sea, and it will only last a certain amount of time. So it's a pretty risky proposition altogether, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yes, propulsion and the battery life was a concern, but a more concern was if there was a fire or a flood. We had nowhere to go quickly, and the reaction to a fire and a flood in the submarine is to make the surface as quickly as possible. So I think it was the danger of that, probably more than running the diesels, that made you tense.
So after Auriga, how long did you spend in Auriga and out there in Canada?
I was out there for 2 years. Of course, quite a good 2 years, because the Canadian Navy didn't really like the cold at the Gulf of St. Lawrence. So come the winter, they would decamp to Bermuda, and of course we had to decamp with them. And our little base was in St. George's Island, and we didn't go down to the main naval base. We tucked ourselves quickly into the top on our own. We had some very pleasant times down there in the sunshine, while our wives back up in Halifax were digging snow from outside the house to get cars out.
I bet that made you popular, very popular with them.
It made telephone calls difficult.
When they asked what their submariner husbands were doing, it must have sounded very envious of what you were doing.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So after Auriga, where did you go next? What was the next?
I went to Sea Lion, a porpoise-class submarine based in Scotland, in Faz Lane. We were mainly involved in North Atlantic, doing exercises, submarine hunting, and sort of general duties. Yeah.
And by this time, the first British nuclear-powered submarines were coming in, the fleet submarines, or hunter-killers, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
So was there a feeling within the dirty boats, as the diesels are called, and that's something we might just want to touch on briefly as well. Was there something within that world of the diesel electric submarine that made people look at them with envy, because they had air conditioning and hot, cold running water, and could keep themselves smart while you were sort of wallowing in the traditional grime of the diesel electric submarine?
Well, sort of. I think we sort of put them down, really, about being softies and how they had an easy life, and the real life was in a diesel submarine, and us pirates were better, stronger, more imaginative. Nuclear submarines had an easy life. But inside ourselves, we were realizing if we didn't go nuclear, we wouldn't carry on. You know, nuclear was the way. But the diesel life had so much to commend it from enjoyment, because we were enjoying ourselves. We were young, being paid to do dangerous things and hunt out an enemy who was quite a good enemy at the time. The whole thing was sort of what we joined for. And it was more exciting in a diesel submarine, we thought, than in a nuclear submarine. But then that was probably for lack of knowledge.
But being a submariner in a diesel electric submarine meant that it was a very peculiar life, wasn't it? I mean, in terms of how you live from day to day.
Yeah. We rough camped, really. You know, no uniform, no washing, minimum of fresh water to be used, 3 or 4 toilets, you know, 70, 80 men sharing very cramped accommodation, smelly, but we all smelt the same, so it didn't matter. That peculiarly flavour of diesel oil, stale cabbage and other things that we always thought the girls ashore thought were so attractive.
A perfume, as it were.
Yes, yeah. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
But they probably thought quite
the opposite.
There was
talk about bottling it at one stage.
Right, yeah, and I bet that didn't get very far.
No, our wives dissuaded us.
Yeah, and so when did you, I mean, did you graduate to the nuclear world in the 1960s, or what happened? I mean, you became a submarine captain. So
my next job was after Sea Lion. I went out, I did a sonar course, because I became very interested in underwater sonar acoustics and things like that. Went off and did a specialist 1-year course, because submariners didn't do any specialist courses on underwater detection. So I did a year's course with the Surface Navy, one of the first submariners to do it. Became a qualified anti-submarine officer, as well as a qualified sonar officer in submarines. Took that back up to Scotland, where I was on the staff of the workup staff there, training submarines and passing on the knowledge I had, which was quite interesting for just over a year. And that interest me involved training the Israeli submarine that was lost.
Right.
Yeah. It sailed from Fas Lane and never got to Israel. It was lost in the Mediterranean. They subsequently found. That was interesting because they were a team who really did see themselves going to war, and they acted at all times in a warlike manner, like they didn't like using the periscope at all, and everything was geared to being at war. You realize the big difference between peacetime safety and wartime operationals. I gain from that was quite interesting.
So that submarine was the Dakar, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Yeah. So that would have been bought from the UK.
Which they bought to go and rename the Dakar.
Bought that, took it out there, think.
Yes, about 67, 66, 67.
Yeah.
I always had a theory as to why she was lost, because when I went on board her, I was the only officer for the workup staff to do time on board her in deeper water. And when I met her in the Clyde to go on board, normally you have to, from a small boat, have to step up onto the casing of a submarine. But I stepped down onto her casing, the top of the submarine, when you're on the surface. And I asked her first lieutenant why they were trimmed down. Why had they reduced the height of the submarine in the water by putting water in the ballast tanks? And he said, we haven't. We haven't. We are at our floating position. And what had happened was, in the conning tower, they had a diver's chamber, which they had filled with heavy spares to take back with them to Israel. And that had reduced the buoyancy of the boat and its draft in the water. So I reckoned it actually had very little buoyancy. If it ever was pushed sideways, it could roll over and not come back up again. Right. And I suspect in the Mediterranean, she probably had a collision with a ship at periscope depth or something like that and had no reserve of buoyancy and probably just went straight to the bottom.
And that was 1968.
Blimey. Well, I was going to say, was sent out to Singapore. Which was a hot war as opposed to a cold war because of the climate, as you might say, and where the Indonesian confrontation had recently sort of come to an end, the whole business of communists and Malaya and Indonesia and Borneo and that sort of thing. I was first lieutenant of Catchlot, another porpoise class, and we spent a lot of time out there practicing what other submarines had done, which was to land special boats, section and SAS personnel from small boats and divers ashore to practice being competent at doing that. And we took part in various exercises with the Australian Navy and Singaporean Navy and other navies. And I had a year out there, which was great. It was the last days of colonial living. Singapore disappeared soon after that. I took my family out, so that was sort of a nice... I thought I was going there for 2 years, but my captain recommended me for Perisher, for command course. So I only had a year and flew home halfway through my appointment to take the commanding officer's course.
So Perisher, periscope course, the command course, was that one that you looked forward to with excitement or trepidation? I mean, it's a very demanding course, and it's quite ruthless in weeding out people that aren't fit for command of a submarine. So was that something that you were mega excited about?
Yes. It's every seaman officer's, submarine seaman officer's ambition was to do Perisher and get command. Because, of course, you got command young in a submarine as opposed to surface ships. I was still a lieutenant. And by the time I finished Perisher, I was still a lieutenant. So I was appointed in command as a lieutenant. So that was a big ambition, but also nervous because we knew it was a tough course, something like a 25 to 30% failure rate. So it wasn't a course you did to become a commanding officer. It was a course you did to become a commanding officer and find out if you were capable of being a commanding officer. It wasn't a training course. It was an evaluation as well.
And how did it go then?
I think I... I obviously was nervous at the beginning. You wondered whether you were ever going to be able to do this. At that time, pre-computers involved a lot of mental arithmetic and intuitive actions. And I thought, I'll never learn the 16 times table, which was sort of what the level you got to. But after 2 or 3 weeks, you could calculate things and multiply and divide mathematically to work out ranges and safety times and all sorts of formula in your head very quickly. So it was that was the biggest challenge, was do I have the mental capability of doing it? Of course, also hidden was, do I have the command capability of doing it, this ability to have a sort of lateral vision while you're focused on the main task of attacking the enemy? Can you also be capable of taking in what's going on around you in the submarine to make sure it's safe, to be aware of all the other things that are going on, not to get lost in the box and too focused?
I mean, I'm obviously aware, because I know your story, that we'll come back to Parachute. Maybe we'll go into the mechanics of it a little bit there rather than now. So once you had passed Perisher, were you then appointed to command a submarine straight away?
Yes, I was appointed to Alliance, HMS Alliance. Now a museum piece, a bit like myself, at Gosport.
Yeah.
In the submarine museum.
Yeah, and the only, well, apart from HMS Courageous, which is at Devonport, a nuclear-powered submarine, but the currently the most accessible and the only diesel-electric submarine open to the public down at Gosport, opposite Portsmouth. So quite a famous submarine. So where did you take command of Alliance?
Well, I took command in Plymouth. We were based in Plymouth, which was the 2nd Submarine Division at the time. We took it out of refit. It was in Chatham, so I had to do the last months of refit, commission it, sail it round to Plymouth, take it up to Scotland, work up, and then take it back to Plymouth, where we were based for the next 2 years for operational deployment. We actually spent most of the time in the Mediterranean, a lot of time in the Mediterranean, because we had a Mediterranean fleet in those old golden days of the Navy, and we were sent there on occasions on a patrol, and we were also sent there as sort of the Thames submarine for helping train the Western Fleet.
So this was the early 70s, the very early 70s.
This is 69, 70, 71. So did Perisher in 69 and commanded through 70, 71.
And so were there any exciting and nail-biting moments in command of HMS Alliance?
Yes, yes, there always are in the submarine, because you're always, two steps from danger. But some are more exciting than others. I think probably my most frightening was the weather experience. We had to go across the Bay of Biscay once, dive, heading south from Plymouth down to Gibraltar, and the RAF wanted to exercise with us before we reached the bay. So we'd had a lot of work with the RAF, which had used up a lot of our battery trying to evade them and things like that. So when they signed off and left us, we had a fairly low battery which needed charging, so we started snorting. But the weather forecast 8 or 9 gales. We headed across the bay with our snort mast up. And if you think about it, all the weather in the Bay of Biscay comes from the west, and your route to Gibraltar is south, so it's all abeam sea. And the weather got worse and worse and worse beyond the forecast, and we were rolling so badly that actually our engines kept cutting out. And every time an engine cuts out, you have to start it with compressed air, and that uses up air in the bottles, and air, because we kept air in bottles for surfacing. And there comes a point when if you do too many engine starts, you've got enough air to surface. But we were also in a shipping lane, so safety was a premium. So we had a problem. And at that point, I started to earn, I think, my command money, because I had to present a fairly calm face to the crew that all was under control. But and they were being extremely sick. The weather was so bad. We were spending 10 minutes each on the periscope, because looking out, rolling all the time was quite difficult. And we reached a point where I thought, if we do another engine start, I'm not going to have enough air to surface. So now is the time, actually, we should surface. And the weather was atrocious, absolutely atrocious. So we had to turn beam on, so we had to the shipping lanes and head into the sea, because it's safer to surface head to sea than beam on, so you're not rolled over. And we had one shot at the surfacing. So we surfaced. Visibility was less than 100 yards. We surfaced okay, turned and headed south again, still in terrible conditions. But for that half hour, I wasn't frightened, but my stomach was pretty clenched.
Yeah. And presumably you were on the snort, so with the submarine rolling and being in such terrible weather, that did that mean that a valve, the reason you couldn't use it to sort of charge the batteries while dived, was because the valve would sort of snap shut?
Yes, the problem is the head of the snort mast is like a giant ping pong ball in a cage, and when the water flows over it, the ping pong ball shuts it so water doesn't come down the air pipe. And that was shutting so often we went, the engine wasn't getting enough air, so we had to stop the engine, and that was happening too often. But we carried on the surface. Once we'd surfaced, that didn't happen. But the waves and the swell was so big, it was unsafe to put anybody up on the conning tower to keep watch, because we were getting swept over by green swell rollers, the Atlantic Ocean washing over us, right up there even. But it wasn't safe to put a man on the bridge. And eventually we thought it was the weather started to decline, and I sent the first attendant up with a lookout, and they were wearing safety harnesses and belts to clip themselves on. And judging by what they said after we put them up there, it was still pretty wet. And about an hour later, the first attendant said, I think it's okay for you to come up and have a look at the weather, sir. So I went up, and as I looked aft, there was this giant sort of 40-foot swell approaching at speed. And I said, firmly, and he said, well, you should have been up here an hour ago, sir.
He thanked him for inviting you up onto the bridge.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're still friends.
I mean, that sounds very, very much like, because we've got very, very little else, you know, to feed our imaginations, that sounds very much like that scene in Das Boot, the German film, where they're all getting doused and soaked, but actually worse than they were experiencing.
Yes. And that was the thing about diesel submarines. Life revolved around charging the battery and getting rid of the sewage. If those were the two prime things that could cripple you, and we've talked about the sewage already. Nuclear submarines, of course, didn't have quite the same problem. That's why we thought it was a soft life in a nuclear submarine, and we were big, bold diesel boatmen.
So having survived the Bay of Biscay, horrendous weather, which was pretty scary, you obviously went on to command Alliance for a little bit longer. But there was one thing about your time in command, which I do recall from our past chats, which is quite remarkable, was your jumper. And what happened to the jumper? Can you tell us about the famous jumper and its ultimate fate?
Yeah, well, listen, this is all part of the diesel submarine mystique, and the fact that we didn't wear uniform, and the clothes we took to sea with us generally were fit for nothing by the time we came back, and we called them gardening clothes or pirate rig. And come the end of my command time, when we're heading back to harbour for the last time to hand over the submarine to the next captain, I'd had a green sweater, which I'd call my lucky sweater. The only time I used to change clothes was before an attack, to indicate this was serious, if we were going into a visual attack or something on the periscope. I would put on this green sweater to indicate that this was serious business now. And that had been with me for 2 years, had quite a lot of holes in it, probably more holes than the sweater. So I just threw it in my waste paper basket in my very tiny cabin as we approached the harbour. Unbeknown to me, my steward retrieved it, or the wardroom steward who looked after me and the officers retrieved the sweater. And it next appeared in a cardboard box covered by a white ensign on a plank on the shoulders of sailors, being carried onto the casing to be buried at sea, with the navigating officer dressed up with a dog collar, a stiff collar on back to front, as a parson to intone the words of burial at sea. And there they all were, standing on the casing with the plank ready to be tipped, and a passing merchant ship, seeing this through his binoculars, kindly yes. dipped his ensign, his red ensign, as my sweater yeah. disappeared into the sea.
Yeah, well, I think that was an honourable burial for such an amazing garment, really, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
And so, you know, having said farewell to your famous green sweater, you left Alliance. And did you then go on to, what did you go on to next?
I was sent as executive officer of HMS Repulse, starboard crew, a Polaris missile submarine based in Scotland.
And being XO, executive officer of a submarine, basically means that you're second command. Is that what it means? Just to give us yes. A simple explanation of what it entails?
Yes, well, each of the Polaris boats, as each of the Triton boats have two crews, and each of the crews has to have two command-qualified officers in charge, the captain and his second-in-command, who has to be command-qualified. So if something goes wrong with the captain, at least you have a command-qualified officer to take over. So having completed my command at Alliance, that was my step into the nuclear world, following 6 months at Greenwich, doing nuclear training geared towards seaman officers' knowledge of it. Interesting aside on that is that there was a mini reactor at Greenwich, which was used for training officers. It could do experiments. It had no real power, really, and it wasn't really a danger, but it did have radioactive material in it, obviously. And Greenwich at the time, of course, was a nuclear-free zone. They never found out about the reactor, though, the local council, until application was made to decommission the reactor, when they realised their nuclear-free zone had actually had this little reactor right. all these years.
Yeah, that was a long time. So that would have been the 90s, I presume.
Yes.
And the college
well,
naval...
When they, yes, yeah. when they decommissioned it, yeah.
Yeah, or whenever it was, yeah, because the college... Yeah. Stayed out until the 90s as a staff training centre. So you're now XO of a Polaris submarine, and it's a different kind of existence to being in a buccaneering piratical diesel electric submarine, I should imagine.
Complete, absolute contrast. The whole Polaris, as it is in Trident now, was carefully planned. You tried to anticipate everything at long range. You didn't do anything too dangerous. You were constantly running away from trouble, trying to avoid being detected. And the whole objective of a Polaris patrol was to be unseen, undetected, and out of sight and out of mind, somewhere in the Atlantic or somewhere else. And actually, apart from every week or 10 days having an exercise to test the missile system was and your alertness, most of the time you were just cruising around in small circles or long straight lines or whatever, just keeping quiet. So it could be quite boring compared with being in a diesel boat or a nuclear hunter-killer. So actually, more time was spent on training and encouraging the crew to have interests and to keep their interest level up, doing really nothing very exciting operationally, just cruising around. There was a whole different concept altogether.
So just to outline it a little bit before I ask the next question, there were four Polaris missile submarines, each armed with 16 nuclear-tipped missiles, and basically the continuous at-sea deterrent from the late 60s. These submarines took it in turn to go out from Faslane, HM Naval Base Clyde, as it is today, out past Northern Ireland, the narrow bit of sea between Scotland and Northern Ireland, out into the Atlantic to lose themselves and, as you say, be very quiet and avoid other vessels and just loiter at walking pace somewhere out there in the Atlantic, alongside American and Russian and French ballistic missile submarines too, as the nuclear deterrent, the mutually assured destruction, ultimate guarantee during the Cold War. So that was mm-hmm. your job, wasn't it?
Yeah. We had three aims of the patrol: to remain undetected, which was very important, to be at 15 minutes notice to fire, and to maintain constant communications in case we got a fire signal. Those were the three aims of the patrol. How you did it then was entirely up to the captain once you got on patrol.
And I visited, not at sea, but alongside of, I've been seeing other submarines, but I visited a Trident submarine and got to walk down between the missile, the ballistic missile tubes or whatever you call them. And it's quite a thought-provoking thing to actually be there. So in a Polaris submarine, that occupying a substantial part of the boat, was it ever present on your minds about the fact that there was sort of world-ending or city-destroying destructive power lurking there in the submarine?
Yeah, you were referring to what we call the Sherwood Forest, which
yes.
Actually its second aim, its second thing was to be the biggest racetrack for cars, scale electrics, probably
right.
Anywhere, definitely at sea, which wound between the tubes.
Yeah.
No, it was something you thought about extremely seriously, but like all, we were all quite young, you think about it, you make your mind up, and then you get on with it. And we were in the Navy, you do what you're told, and, you know, there is a certain amount of conformism. There were quite a few people who didn't wish to have command of a Polaris boat and didn't. And they weren't court-martialed or anything. They were just allowed not to do it. Their careers perhaps didn't proceed quite as fast as they might have done. But, yeah, you thought about it, made up your mind, and then got on with it.
And to occupy your time, I mean, you talked about the scale electric track running around the tubes there, and people would have, I know, would have competitions with their cars and would tweak them, and that would keep them their minds occupied and distracted from I suppose, the boredom or the tedium, comparatively, of being out there for weeks at a time, not being able to see the surface of the sea, not being able to see the world outside, away from their families. But there were all sorts of other things going on in the submarine as well, weren't there? For people were studying, and they were even, I believe, making model kits as well. There was all sorts of hobbies going on, weren't there?
Yeah, it was. I mean, our patrols on average were about 6 weeks, some longer, some a bit shorter. So it was a very good opportunity to pursue something of interest. A lot of people took outside university degrees. A lot of people did model making, but there was a restriction on what sort of materials you could use because of atmosphere control. Some people wrote. I can't recall a novelist coming out of it particularly famous, but people had to have an interest. Otherwise, you could just go slightly mad, I suppose, because just sitting there. So a lot of time was spent in maintaining morale and encouraging people to have an interest outside of their immediate job.
And the you're talking about people might think you've gone mad, but I gather there was one trick you used to do. I know it's a trick you used to use, was walking your dog, inverted commas, between the missile tubes. So was that...
Well, yes, it was one Sunday. I just felt life was a bit flat mid-patrol. It was too early to have the end of patrol concert. Things were just getting a bit flat. And we ran a ship's newspaper, and the news was getting a bit flat. So I just thought, let's do something different, just perhaps to be a bit quirky. So I put a bit of string on a scrubbing brush, and on a Sunday morning after church, because we always had church, not many people went, but everybody complained if you didn't have it, because it was part of the routine. And I took my dog for a walk down the main passageway, and Polaris submarines had quite a long main gangway, much more space than Trident submarines, which, from my memory of going on board one, have bends and the whole thing is much more compact, whereas a Polaris submarine was a bit more open, so it was more like a little road with people coming and going. Strolled down the road with my dog.
Right.
I might have thought I was peculiar, but I was greeted by people saying, "Morning, sir. What's it called? Don't let your scrubbing brush lift its leg on my deck. I've just scrubbed it." And people just took it on the run, you know. So we were all a touch, perhaps, strange.
British humour. You call British humour.
Yeah.
And I suppose it made a lead story in the submarine.
Submarine newspaper, something to write about. Yeah.
Yeah. And but looking at the routine of the submarine, a large submarine for its day, a large submarine, I gather that you were always conscious as the XO that there might be people in the far reaches of the submarine at night, or you know when other people are off watch, and maybe they were working on something somewhere that might need a chat, or you just wanted to check on them. So you had a bit of a patrol routine, I believe.
Yes, well, I'm as second in command. I was not a watchkeeper unless I chose to be, to relieve somebody for some particular reason. But I was not a watchkeeper. But I had quite a lot of at night. I wasn't necessarily on watch or anything. So and sleeping was not a problem. You know, daytime, sort of your whole diurnal rhythm had changed. So quite often around about 2 or 3 in the morning, which is probably the low point in most people's morale position, and people sitting quietly on their own think too much. I used to wander through the submarine from one end to the other, just seeing how it was doing and chatting to people, because there were some watchkeepers at the extremities who were on their own. Adjusted, and people talk at that time of night, so it was just a habit. But it also, one other thing that struck me was that we go for weeks at sea on patrol, and we did safety checks before we dived and dive. But it did occur to me, if somebody wanted to be mischievous and try and damage the submarine in some way, that there was an opportunity in these silent hours to actually affect some of the valves or things that affect safety in the submarine. So one of the small things I did, which kept me occupied on one patrol, was to look at which of the safety systems that ensured the survival of the submarine should be checked daily, as opposed to after diving and not before you come into harbour. So it was my small contribution to Polaris safety was to institute daily safety checks of key equipment.
Thank you for listening to part one of our dive into the submarine world of Rob Forsyth. And in part two, we'll be learning all about an exciting encounter between a Polaris missile submarine, which Rob was second in command of, and a Russian spy vessel, which caused a crash dive. And also his time as the captain of a hunter-killer submarine, and his own version of, sort of, the hunt for Red October. For more Warships IFR, you can visit our website at warshipsifr.com, follow us on Facebook at Warships IFR, and also Twitter at Warships IFR. And we also have a YouTube channel called Warships IFR TV. Thank you for listening, and there will be another episode of the Warships Pod unleashed soon.